nature tourism gets no more extreme than Mount Everest. Each year sees increasing numbers of trekkers, climbers and tourists in the region. The evident dangers and risks are in many ways the essence of its attraction. An experience to find yourself, define yourself or even display yourself. The establishing of cellular and Wi-Fi coverage has meant that even more images are generated each season. How might the experience of Everest be studied from the perspective of anthropology and media? Hello and welcome to the GeoMedia podcast. Today I talk to Jelena Senanen from the University of Manchester, who is working on just this project. Welcome to the podcast. Your project is concerned with aspects of mobile media and map apps in relation to Mount Everest and the tourism there. First of all, let's start with this thing of Everest. What is this attraction? I was interested to see that one article of yours is titled Everest, Everest Land, hashtag Everest, which would indicate something. What do you feel are the why it's become such a central location for a particular kind of experience?
Thank you for having me along for the podcast, John. Everest has been a long-standing fascination of mine, and for many years, just a fascination. I had no interest to go, no interest to do in-depth research there. That ended up being a bit of a coincidence. But it was that initial fascination with Everest, but not wanting to go, which kind of made me take it to the next level with the research, in that it's just so symbolic and it's just so representative of aspirations, hopes, dreams, physical achievement. Everyone who, not everyone, but we hear quite in commonplace conversations, you know, such and such is the Everest of whatever vocation or interest or hobby. It has a particular, it's the imagination of Everest, I think, that drew me to the project. And then how the steps between the imagination of Everest and then embarking upon such physical extremes to, you know, conquer Everest. Conquer is the word historically used. Tick it off the bucket list, challenge oneself, achieve my dream, all of this sort of language. So I think it's the imagination that drew me to the project. And now a few years into the project and hearing the narratives and connotations and associations that people have with it, it is very much this, it's become almost a hyper version of what it was in the early 20th century. And now we're in the early 21st century. We're actually 100 years from the first attempt by Mallory and the reconnaissance missions by reconnaissance expeditions by the British. So we have a very specific moment in we're in a very specific historical moment, not just about the mountain's very long history, but I think a largely capitalist imagination of how we treat and think about this mountain. So tracing that kind of 100-year history, and now we're in an accelerated moment where Everest is more accessible than ever before. I think it's the social changes that come about from these imaginative processes that I'm more interested in.
So do you see it then as a fundamentally Western obsession?
Historically, it has definitely been a predominantly Western obsession. And that starts all the way back to the British conquests, the British conquest of Everest in leading up to 1924, not 2024. My abbreviation for 24. I have to be very careful about that now. Prior to those initial attempts, mountaineering was very much dominated by, leisure mountaineering was very much dominated by more Western Europeans, so Swiss with the Alps, that sort of thing, in the emerging middle class. So you all of a sudden had weekend trips, just being able to sort of go leisure walking, Switzerland, France, Germany, that sort of thing. But extreme mountaineering was very much a British phenomenon, to do with firstly the expansion of the British Empire, and then secondly the historical kind of events leading up to the destabilization of British imperialism in the early 20th century. And then thirdly, this all kind of accelerated with the coronation of the new queen in the 50s. As you may recall, the year that Sir Edmund Hillary and Tenzing Norgay first reached the top of Everest was the same year as the Queen's coronation. So there's very much a British historical moment that has shaped the imagination of seeking to embark upon ascending the mountain.
That's it. I mean, that, as you say, the ascent of Everest by Edmund Hillary, as you say, is certainly within British culture, I think, tied into the coronation, because it was the first televised coronation, and then the announcement long before I was born. So I mean, it's an historical event, but certainly figured in that way. So it can certainly be understood, I think, in that context of empire and symbolic kind of dominance and things like that. Obviously, to a certain extent, paradoxically, a point precisely when the empire is fragmenting, and it's presumably a part of an attempt to hold on to something in a symbolic way. How has that kind of, and again, to me, I would presumably trace back the practice of mountaineering and climbing to the kind of alpine culture of Europe, and quite Germanic in different ways. How's that translated then into a more modern sense of tourism, given the extremity of this particular experience? How has it, again, in quite a surprising way for many people, become a place of tourism? I mean, the region itself certainly has had a mystique for a long time, the hippie trail and various things. So there's a certain sense of an interpretation, shall we say, to put it generously, of a certain spiritual value and Buddhism and that kind of thing. But how has the mountain itself become a site of tourism?
This is where the bridging between the historical imagination of Everest in terms of the history of mountaineering, its associations with empire, conquest, all these sorts of things, and the modern day tourist phenomenon that we are now over familiar with. This is where us as media scholars and different kind of media scholars, this is where we can really flourish. And surprisingly, it's a small area of Everest research. Arguably, the tourism phenomenon has come about because the history of Everest as we know it has been so mediatized from that first moment in the 20s. So as part of those initial expeditions, a filmmaker and a photographer kind of went along. His name was Captain John Knoll, and he made two films, Climbing Mount Everest from 1922 and then The Epic of Everest in 1924. These were the first sort of cinematic depictions and at the time quite remarkable uses of media technologies on the expeditions. So the second film covers Mallory's attempt. There was actually, I mean, we now that we're 100 years into the sort of centenary of these first attempts, the Royal Geographical Society just had a brilliant exhibition about some of these aspects of mediatization of Everest. There's notable British historians who've done a lot of work in this area. So Jeanette Faul, for example, that's Faull, if you're interested in her work. That exhibition and this historian pretty much looks at that moment of mediatization through the technological wonders of early 20th century filmmaking, which was a big part of that initial dissemination of British knowledge about Everest mountaineering from the 20s. And then you fast forward to exactly as you say, the Queen's coronation was also televised. The story of Jan Morris and how they were able to sort of transmit the information and the story about the first attempt by Hillary and Norgay, and that they had finally reached the summit. I mean, encoded messages, things like that, going to Darjeeling just to keep it a secret, and also then to coincide the release of that information to coincide with the coronation. Again, hugely huge strategy based on media technologies. And then fast forward again to 1996. 1996 is everyone from tourist imagination, everyone who would know about Everest now would most likely know it from the 1996 disaster. In terms of that was the John Krakauer novel, which then became film in 2015. The film in 2015 that came out was the same year as the avalanche, which was also heavily mediatized, which was also, heavily covered by the media. 1996 was also the IMAX film. So that disaster was the site of huge media coverage from several angles, cinematic, best-selling author, and of course, news media. And then you fast forward again to the late 2000s, where after the avalanche and the earthquakes, it was the cooperation between the Nepali state government, humanitarian efforts, and private telecommunications companies that enabled the development of Wi-Fi technologies on the mountain. So mountaineers were starting to kind of, you know, tweet from the top and send photos from the top, but it really became mainstream after 2015, where you have Wi-Fi technologies available up to base camp and beyond. So there's very much a sense of, and this is one of the arguments for those of us who look at the more sociological and anthropological aspects of media practices and media imaginations and their relationship with space and place, is that because Everest is so heavily mediatized, it gives the impression that it reduces, and this is Elizabeth Mazzolini's argument, it kind of makes that scale accessible. It reduces the scale of Everest, it reduces the sublimity of Everest to something that's very portable. And once it's portable, all of a sudden it becomes more consumable, because of course, so much of media technologization in the late 2000s and up to now is about this sort of intertwined relationship between commercial interests as well as media practices. So, and I'm talking here about, you know, connotations that we would know about, clickbait, the sort of, you know, sensationalist sort of posts, all of these sorts of things. One of the reasons why Everest is such a heavily demanded tourist, and I would go so far to say tourist product or tourist commodity, is because it has been packaged and sold through media for over 100 years now.
So I'm interested a little bit in this idea, just I think finally on this thing around Everest, in the same way that could propose that the tying of achieving the summit of Everest with empire and Britain, just as that's turning away from that, is there a similar sense? Because I'm thinking, again, the way that Mazzolini talks about Everest as provides a narrative that has strongly influenced Western people's sense of what it means to be human. Is there a sense in which, as, I don't know, again, this isn't, I would not be someone who's motivated for adventure tourism in any kind of way. I'm also very scared of heights, so this would be not an experience that I would embark on. But is there a sense in which, as life becomes more secure and more safe, then there is this impulse for seeking out some affirmation and valorization of danger in that kind of context? Is that part of what Everest is about?
Absolutely. That idea that you're alluding to and that Mazzolini captures is very much part of the, again, the sort of Western individualist modern historical moment. Those arguments come from more sort of the North American leisure tourism for wilderness and frontier. It has its origins in the more sort of, you know, benign and everyday and mundane sort of aspects of camping, or, you know, going on hikes and carrying your own stuff, all of that sort of thing. And that was, these sorts of holidays became part of the middle class, during the same time as around Fordism, factory work, all these sorts of things, where work life became quite regimented. Aspirations were very much around comforts. At first, maybe sort of simple and meager comforts, a nice home, these sorts of things. So something to counter that, the weekends away, going back to nature, being more self-sufficient. And now, again, 100 years later, we see the extremes of that. And the language around it is also one of it strangely resonates with the entrepreneur kind of discourses around pushing one's limits, exceeding one's expectations, all like the economic language around exceeding what one should comfortably be able to manage or embark upon doing, also translates to adventure tourism in terms of, you know, more, bigger, better, extreme, more danger, and, you know, confronting oneself in that face of danger. But the irony about embarking on treks and to the more extreme mountaineering with Everest, these are extremely, again, commercially managed risks. And we're starting to see that now with the narratives of Sherpa and, to a lesser extent, other ethnic populations from surrounding regions of Nepal, so Tamang and Rai, for example, who have made up the bulk of the workforce for a number of years. And the roles that Nepali workers, and I'm saying Nepali here as the, you know, kind of draw the contrast here collectively, you see the kind of contrast, sorry, you see the kind of narratives that give visibility, I wouldn't say voice, to workers in terms of their roles, where their roles are very much about managing this risk, where the consumer, the tourist, embarks upon this risk, but there is a very intact economic and social infrastructure whose sole responsibility is to manage this risk.
You do talk about this, the development of this, this is an extension, if you like, of a form of trekking and wayfinding, I think you talk about as well. But just on that point around, why does it draw? I mean, you talk about the entrepreneurial concept, which I think is very, very important. I could see how that would fit into a certain kind of idea there. But you do, in some of your interviews, for instance, you do interview solo women trekkers and things like this. And there does seem to be a certain fetishization of the solo nature of some of these journeys. I mean, do you think that's motivated from a similar kind of space as those, you know, ideas of self-belief and self-worth, or what do you think that is? It seemed to be gendered a little bit in terms of the accounts that you gave.
Definitely. In terms of the relationship between embarking on these sorts of adventure travel, navigating individual risk and going as a solo traveler, it's not that the narratives reveal not only a sense of just self-belief, self-sufficiency, all these sorts of things, but also expertise. So there's definitely a sense of, and thankfully, none of my respondents kind of said, well, I did my research, because I would have really, you know, gone into depth. What do you mean by research? It's not so much the I did my research, but it's very much I have a certain level of experience that I've accumulated from trekking here or going there or trying some other trying other forms of adventure travel or adventure tourism or trekking, and then embarking on Everest as an extension of that. I probably should also clarify that in some of the there's a few papers now. I've been writing about this for some time, but some of the trekkers in some of the papers who were along the Everest Base Camp trek, they were on their way to the Three Passes, which is a different destination to Everest Base Camp. Everest Base Camp is probably the most popular, and it's probably the most populated trek. But Three Passes is more remote. It's much harder. And the individuals that embark upon the Three Passes trek are usually more experienced than those who embark upon the Everest Base Camp trek. Drawing that distinction mainly because Everest Base Camp trek is hard. It's cold, it's high, it's hard. But it is, again, coming back to that risk, it's extremely well managed in terms of the infrastructure that's available. It really is going from point A to point B to point C, and it is pretty difficult to, unless you're deliberately straying off that particular trek, it's pretty difficult to end up by yourself. However, Three Passes, different story. It just changes with weather patterns. It changes with visibility. It doesn't have like so much of a fixed sort of trail. So that the trekkers who embark upon it, actually, I would argue and have argued, they do have a certain level of experience and expertise that that your average trekker on Everest Base Camp trek does not have, relatively. So, however, but with the narratives that they present, yes, on the one hand, it is about testing oneself. Those themes are still there, but there's more of an element of expertise, and it's an extension of other kinds of adventure travel and adventure tourism practices.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting distinction there, definitely. Let's talk a little bit about this idea of technology then. Of course, so you use the phrase navigation and expertise and the interrelationship between those things. And at one point you described the GPS navigators as navigationally antisocial. What's your kind of background to that kind of distinction?
Yeah, that was a sort of my synthesis of a few scholars who've worked in this area, particularly from a few pieces I've read in the journal Tourism Geographies, so relying solely on the GPS navigation of the phone or the little dot, the little blue dot to take you from here to there. This sort of branch of scholarship kind of argues that by relying on one's own navigation, and it's very much the direct image of head in the phone, using the phone as a compass, it's not necessarily deliberate, but it definitely detracts from all the other modes of wayfinding or being able to find your way around you. So particular landmarks, particular forms of communication, for example, getting to a certain point and then, you know, speaking to those around you just to check where you are. So in terms of the antisocial nature of relying on a GPS kind of device or GPS afforded device, from this branch of thinking, it reduces all the other types of navigational resources that we might have out, sensorially, again, physically and memory wise, for example, sort of seeing a certain point and then, you know, sort of registering that and moving along. And then the most basic one of communication. So there's been a number of studies that have been done about just urban wayfinding or within tourist sites where people, you know, sort of no longer stop and ask people for directions. And from, again, this sort of branch of scholarship, it then reduces interactions with locals, which has a whole bunch of other sort of connotations as well.
So could you explain this distinction between wayfinding and wayfaring a bit more for us?
Sure. So wayfinding emphasizes directions. So going from place to place, it emphasizes more the origin point and reaching the destination point. So it's where the main sort of aim is to reach the destination. So for example, through transport, where travel is very much, reaching from one point to another. So wayfaring comes from anthropologist Tim Ingold. And he distinguishes that wayfaring is different from wayfinding, as it encompasses more of the sensory, the feelings, the perceptions, the forms of knowledge, the forms of practices that it takes to navigate different environments. So it's about drawing on different. So, for example, if you're in an unfamiliar place, you're drawing on your different kinds of experiences and knowledge. To feel and find your way, and to navigate that particular environment. He makes that he sort of comes up with that idea to give a richer account to sort of individual and collective kinds of navigation.
Good. Yeah, I think it's a very useful kind of distinction. I just wanted to look a bit more at this idea of, as you say, navigationally antisocial and this a reduction, at least, a reducing of engagement with the environment and, for want of a better description, kind of local culture. You seem to frame that as something corrosive to a certain extent, that it has a negative impact, shall we say, upon people there. How do you perceive it, really?
I'm looking at this theme in a lot more depth when I return for fieldwork later this year. Because one of the themes that has come up, not only from speaking with many people who work in the tourism industry, but it's also become more of a concern in the wider sort of discussions of research, that when we're talking about specifically Everest, so it's in the Solokhumbu region, bordering Tibet, on northern Nepal. So original inhabitants were Sherpa, but also increasingly Tamang and Rai. We also forget that we're talking about indigenous populations here, indigenous populations who have had centuries, arguably millennia, of intergenerational indigenous knowledges about the place. And we then get the two kinds, and definitely knowledge that's in competition. The highly technologized knowledge that we see through, for example, map apps, again, to come back to the, tourists doing their research, so blogs, brochures, all the way back to historical accounts, novels. These are ways of knowing the mountain and ways of knowing the region that are inseparable from the sort of binary of imperial and indigenous, sort of, conquest inhabitants. So the ways that technologies embody forms of Westernized, or Eurocentric or dominant forms of knowledge are very much to the detriment, and I like the way that you framed it, corrosion, of indigenous knowledges and practices. So, for example, to bring it back to that point about wayfaring, for a lot of the sort of regional workforce, wayfaring includes being able to read weather. And being able to read, and I don't mean that in sort of, mystic or mysticized, exoticized, othering kind of way. I mean very directly, there is a cloud coming over there. It is going to be here in less than 2 hours. We need to be out of here. So can everyone just hurry up a bit? That even those very, very basic things from, everything from you're out here a bit longer, you're going to be a bit uncomfortable too. If you're out here, we are going to be in trouble. So even just those very basic mundane routine things about reading very simple weather patterns, where on Everest, which is notoriously unpredictable, so the way that the way that technologies are embraced to an extent for the illusion of being able to provide information as opposed to relying or even consulting or asking regional experts who are drawing on multiple forms of intergenerational knowledge. So it's, yeah, these sorts of distinctions are becoming more important. So, you know, information versus knowledge, expertise in terms of sort of technologized expertise versus different ways of knowing. So those are sort of, those are some of the areas that, that the themes that you're asking about become important.
And how do you see, I think you say that travelers don't rely on Google Maps so much because if they go offline, then it's not as useful. But do you see the apps themselves as, in a kind of epistemological way, kind of generating a certain kind of bias or privileging of one experience over another?
It's not a straightforward matter of trust, but it's definitely a form of, and this is where I think that, again, that that narrative of individual, whether it's ability or resilience or whatever, comes into it. But it's the privileging of, I can read a map, so I can do this, rather than there's something almost, you know, defeating about, I need to ask somebody who might be able to know this better than me, because that implies I need to depend on somebody, I need to rely on somebody, and I'm not able to do this thing that I've set out to do by myself. So I think there's several layers that's kind of going on there, in that preference for map apps and independent trekking to hiring a guide. That's also come from the legacies of tourism itself. The sort of, you know, oh, hiring a guide, hiring a porter. I'm not one of those people. So there's a little bit of that as well. And then again, this was just so straightforward in terms of, you know, a possible third option. Guides themselves are very much, we understand what, you know, that people come to this region. They come with certain level of skills and certain levels of expertise and experience. We don't want to dictate what trekkers can and can't do. But how about a system such as, there are accommodation points all the way up on, along the main treks. You check into an accommodation point, working with a guide for a section of any trek. That was their suggestion. So that seems like a quite straightforward one. It doesn't have to be either or. It's very much, especially when you don't know what conditions are going to change. I mean, people sign up for a 16, 24-day trek, whatever. You don't know what the conditions are going to be like in day eight when you're in Lukla, you know, 2,000 meters below on day one. So the ways that there are just so many stark binaries in the way to go about trekking that is kind of at the detriment to trekkers and the regional workforce alike.
Sure. Well, I mean, this sounds a very kind of rich area of investigation. What exactly are your future plans with regard to this project?
So the project started out as mobile media and mobile livelihoods, because I was interested in looking at the regional populations who live in the area or come in and out seasonally to work in Everest trekking. And then, of course, mobile media, that was a very fortuitous research moment. It was the first 5 years of digital infrastructure in the Everest region. I went back to field work now last year in April, and the aim was just to pick up the research where it had left off, reconnect with the guides and porters that I had been working with, and they all pretty much said, we don't want to talk about phones anymore. We've been living on our phones for the last 2 years. So in the spirit of participatory research and collaborative research, I kind of asked, well, what would you like to talk about? And this is where it has shaped the next few years, which I'm tremendously happy about. They want to, so many changes have happened in the tourist industry over the last 2 years. And there's a kind of reckoning with the impacts of climate change, environmental sustainability, their livelihoods. I mean, they're an aging population as well. And there's a lot more kind of reflection about the changes in the tourist industry. So the project has kind of grown quite a lot. So it's going to be a long-term ethnography. The project is called The Everest Economy. Whether the book is that, don't know yet. And it's looking at three generations of guides in and porters in Everest trekking and mountaineering industry. So many guides and porters were introduced to the work by their father or by uncles. So in terms of like the so-called, you know, the first sort of 50 years of trekking tourism, I'm now looking at three generations. So I've worked with the sort of middle generation and then the younger generation, mostly through this digital research. So when I go back, I'm going to start to speak with the previous generation of guides and porters. They have, you know, the close guides that I've been working, the guides I've been working with closely, they've kind of said, well, there's only one way that you can do that properly. In 2027, you're going to have to do Everest Base Camp trek again. I'm like, oh, hell no, I'm not. You don't know how old I'm going to be then. I'm not doing that. And they said, no. We'll tell you why you need to do it. The first time you did that trek when you started the research was 2017. And you'll probably have been the only person to have done it across 10 years at multiple times. And you yourself will see the changes that we're talking about. So they've planned that for me, and that's the next steps for this research.
Great. Well, that sounds both exciting and interesting and challenging. So we look forward to seeing how that goes. Thank you very much for talking today about the project.
Thank you so much, John.